Ladies and gentlemen, please stand by. We are about to begin. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Durant and Legacy Society's conference call with Sheila Shaw Horton, Vice President and Dean of Students. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. And now, your host for today's conference, Ms. Dina Borton, I'm sorry, Boren K. Rashes, class of 1996. Dina, please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. I'm delighted to welcome you to the second Durant and Legacy Society conference call of the academic year. I am Dina Boren K. Rashes, class of 1996, chair of the Durant Society. Also joining me is Laura Christian, director of the Wellesley Fund. At this time, I want to let you know that we will be shortening the call today by 15 minutes in order to accommodate a shift in scheduling due to yesterday's college closure. As the question and answer portion will be impacted, we ask that you limit yourself to one question per person. Thank you in advance for understanding. I continue to be humbled by the role that the Durant and Legacy Societies play in the financial health of the college, and I'm so grateful to see the membership of both societies growing. Thank you for your generous support, your investment in Wellesley, and championing women who will make a difference in the world. The Durant Society continues to trend ahead of last year with 1,047 members contributing well over $26 million this fiscal year. The Wellesley Legacy Society honors those who have made life income gifts for the college and or remembered Wellesley in their estate plans. To date, the college has raised nearly $3.6 million in planned gifts and over $7 million in documented bequest intentions. I'd like to remind you that every gift and bequest intention counts towards the campaign to advance the Wellesley effect. And at this time, I'm pleased to announce that we have raised $475 million towards our goal of $500 million. Now, I'm pleased to introduce Sheila Shaw Horton. Dean Horton became the Vice President and Dean of Students at Wellesley College in early July 2017. She comes to us from Loyola University, Maryland, where she was Vice President and Dean of Students for 6 years, overseeing a division of 15 different departments spanning areas such as residential life, public safety, counseling, wellness, alcohol and drug services, recreational sports, services for students with disabilities, and other student support areas. Prior to Loyola, she spent 25 years at Boston College in several roles, including Associate Vice President and Dean of Students. Dean Horton has experienced and observed the many facets of student life from a multitude of vantage points. In addition to her decades of administrative experience, she has taught undergraduate and graduate students, is a trustee of her alma mater, Emmanuel College, and is herself the parent of a new college graduate. She holds a master's degree and PhD in counseling psychology from Boston College. Thank you, Dean Horton, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Dina. And thank you for leading the Durant Society, and thank you to all of you on the call for your generosity and involvement in Wellesley College. So I look forward to sharing with you now a little bit of my observations as a new dean here at Wellesley, recognizing this is still my first year, and I'm still pretty new and learning a lot about the culture. But there have been some observations, and I'm one of those deans who finds herself in every area and space around campus. I go to student functions. I go to the residence halls. I invite students to come and meet with me. And so I'm going to share with you a little bit about that experience and a little bit about what I've learned from that. And then I'll take questions. So I'll start with what I say is sort of to state the obvious, which is that Wellesley College students are extremely bright, very hardworking, very ambitious. And one of the things that made me want to come to work at Wellesley was indeed working with these students. Emmanuel College, when I went there, was a women's college, and so I really know that experience of going to a women's college, and I also know what it's like having deans and adults that are invested in your success. And so coming here, I was really looking forward to meeting with them. And so that's one of the things that I found with our students is indeed they live up to the hype, if you will, that Wellesley College students are extremely smart. As you know, 99% of them live on campus, and they live in residence halls that are traditional halls with the doubles, singles, and very few suite-style rooms. So probably very much like what you remember when you were a student. And the Wellesley College students are very diverse. And, you know, we know about the racial diversity. Those stats are always out there. But important to also recognize, race, ethnicity, religion, gender identity, sexual orientation, disability, international status, that our students have intersectionalities in many different ways. And so getting to know them gives you a sense that this is not at all a homogeneous place, that all of the students, no matter what they look like, also bring so many other identities with them. And it's been really enjoyable getting to know them and to learning about that. I want to give you an example of the ways in which I got to know some students. So the very first thing we did when students moved in is I went in and met with all the RAs, and I visited with students as they were moving in and met their parents and welcomed them. And the RAs here are full of energy and full of life. They love selfies, so we did lots of selfies. And I'm on Twitter, so they were all over Twitter with me. We also had Paula Johnson join us. Paula Johnson joined us for some of the first year visits, and again, she's just lovely. The students love her. They call her PJ, which I get a kick out of. I also wanted to make sure the students knew where to find me. So as part of the first year student orientation, I built into their program that they do a scavenger hunt, and so I built into the scavenger hunt that they needed to come to the dean's office. So all the first-year students found their way up here. It kind of overwhelmed the third floor of Green Hall, but it was kind of fun. And it was really funny. When I first moved into my office, I said, we're going to need a couch for the students. And my assistant said, well, you know, in the dean's office, the students don't really come that much. So I said, no. I'm here now. They're coming. Get the couch. We got the couch, and students... Yeah, I took pictures and showed the students, yes, this is a place where you can come. So it's been great. I also went to many of the initial programs that I thought was really not just lovely events like Flower Sunday. Many of you might remember Flower Sunday. Flower Sunday is this program that happens on the night before classes start. And the students, it's held in the chapel, and there's music, and there's dancing, and there's a speaker from each class. And they're welcoming the first-year students. And as the students enter, they receive flowers from their bigs. They get the big sisters in the residence halls. And so it's one of these cultural traditions that passes on important messaging to the first-year students. And so as I observed it, it was really clear to me that this is one of the ways that Wellesley prepares students for the kinds of relationships that last forever. I went to other traditions like step singing, and that was a lot of fun. I got to sort of see all the classes. I realized I will have to purchase a purple outfit for graduation, but all the different color classes was a lot of fun. And then I went to so many other places on what I call my listening tour. So in addition to the campus events, I also went to the training for all the student leaders. I went to the dinner, the first generation college student dinner. I visited with the house presidents. I go to tea in all of the different residence halls. I had small group meetings with the leaders of the different cultural groups. So all the different cultural groups come together once a month with their advisors. And so I went in and met with all of them. I also met with, go to the college government senate meetings on Mondays. So I'm really in all these spaces and places. And the message that I've said to students is that the dean of students here is going to be responsive to you and know that if issues come up that you can come and see me. And also that it's going to be accessible. So don't ever feel like the administration is not accessible or not here for you. I try to make sure I sent that message. And then I'm listening to what you have to say. And so what I've been hearing is a pretty consistent message. When you think about all the different people that I've spoken to, it's interesting that almost in every group, I've heard the same thing. They love their professors. The faculty here are really important to the students. Their major subjects are important to them as well. Their resident hall community, the students, the other people that they live, and their desire to be Wellesley alums. Almost every group mentioned part of why they're coming. In fact, one student said, when I asked the question, why did you come to Wellesley, I want to be a Wellesley alum, which I thought was also remarkable. And I also asked them of their concerns. What are the things that worry you? What are the things that you'd like to change about your experience here? And almost all of them talk about stress. They talk about mental health as an issue, particularly of their peers. You know, this is a generation of people that worry about others a lot. Even when you think about today, the protests for gun violence, this is a generation of young people that care a lot about others. And so they worry about their peers. They also worry about their ability to engage in conversation across difference. So, you know, our climate right now, the politics is so polarized, and our students understand the importance of being able to engage across difference, but they also recognize that they don't have the skills to do that. And so wanting more connection around that. And they also want the facilities of the residence halls improved. I mean, they're old and they need a little love. what I'm hearing loud and clear, though, from the students is this need for balance, and that they're working hard. And in a lot of places, you know, there's a work hard, play hard mentality, and here it's a work hard, work harder mentality, that they just feel like there isn't enough space and time to socialize. And we have to, you know, talk about that. Some of that is their fault. They have to own that, and so I'll talk a little bit later about what we're doing about that. Also, what I'm hearing from them is a lot of complaints about Peter Pan bus. We're going to have to do something about that bus. Those of you who graduated not too long ago probably understand, but it's just a thing. Peter Pan bus, taking them off to MIT. Many of them take MIT classes, and it just, for some reason, students don't understand that traffic is actually not as easily scheduled as you might think. But there were some other things that I observed that students didn't necessarily say to me, but that I observed. And first of all, like that the residence hall spaces are absolutely elegant and historic. I mean, they're just beautiful buildings. But indeed, they do need updating and repair. And that while students don't necessarily complain about that, it does add to their feeling of being valued and being cared for. We have a remarkable student governance system that has not only your regular college government, but that has the house councils and it has the house presidents, and it's quite an elaborate system. And there's ways in which we can really leverage that for the empowerment, and I'm already starting to do that a little bit. Because both the positive and the negative culture can get transmitted. So the notion of, as I mentioned earlier, how we send messages of you are valued, you are important, you can handle it, right? But then the other messages of things like there's grade deflation, which there really isn't, but they tell you, they send these messages throughout. And then also I've had to spend some time talking with students about what a Dean of Students does, because this entire generation of students has actually not had a Dean of Students because there's been a lot of transition. So I've spent a fair amount of time with that. Every incoming student has about five different students that are there for them. They have their RA, they have academic success coaches, there are athletic mentors, there are first-year mentors, there are big sisters. So the good news is that there are so many students and others around, and I really think that leveraging that peer leadership is a great way for us to send good messages. And peer leadership is really important because it establishes the norms and it promotes a sense of community for students. But also, these peer opportunities promote personal development and give students valuable work experience. It gives them skills that they can use out there in the workforce. I think we need to do a better job of helping them to articulate that and learning about this. So that's one of the things that we're taking on, is how do we help students articulate that they're learning and that they actually are developing skills from their engagement in peer leadership activities. When I listen to the students and I think about what they've said to me, I also recognize that there's a national phenomenon going on. That indeed, an article that was written last in October in the New York Times talked about the fact that anxiety and depression is a significant force that's happening in high schools, and that students are arriving at college already having significant mental health challenges. And so when our students are saying that they're concerned about this, they're coming from a place of reality. They've seen it in their high schools. They're seeing it here on the campus. And so it is something that we really need to take seriously and to plan for how we're going to address. The American College Health Association reported that there was an increase, 62%, in 2016, when we look at the anxiety and depression, compared to only 50% in 2011. So already it has gone up. And we're noticing that in our counseling center as well, that students are utilized in counseling at a higher rate now over the past 4 years. So it is consistent with what's happening nationally. And so we've been really thinking about what we can do differently. How do we leverage our resources better to be able to address that? So in thinking about what I've learned in this first semester and a half, I've learned that we need to leverage the strengths of our peer model by increased training and leadership development, that we need to embrace this diversity of our student body and strengthen intercultural education, that health and wellness is clearly rising to the top. And as you know, that's also Paula Johnson considered that to be a top priority, so we're very much in sync there. And a lot of resource and support from her. We want to build stronger bonds in the residence halls by creating a more social atmosphere, which people might think that, well, you know, they're here for college, they're here for education, but when you think back on what, you know, your relationships that you still have 10 and 15 years later, it's the fun that you had, right? It's not the studying that you did. Although some of the studying, but it's really the fun. So we need to make sure that our students are having fun. More fun. Lastly, help them to engage the national issues more broadly. So altogether, this new vision for student life at Wellesley comes down to three simple words. We need to embrace our students, embrace their intersectionality, embrace their sense of belonging, embrace their identity, embrace the fact that they're growing, and that they're not coming to us as perfect people, and that we have to help them to grow and change and become the amazing Wellesley alums that they're going to be. Secondly, we need to engage them, and we do that through the student activities, but also through health and wellness activities, through social life. Engage them actively and help them to pay attention to what they're learning as they're engaging in these. And then finally, empower them through our leadership development training, through career development, and really through helping them to take responsibility for their own education. You know, this is a population of people who, you remember they used to talk about helicopter parents? Well, so this is the generation of snowplow parents. If you think about this, they move all the obstacles out the way so that the student can skate right on through. Well, when you've never had obstacles to deal with, then when they do confront you, they become that much more stressful. So we have to help people to understand that obstacles are a normal part of growth and development, and so we will empower students to address those obstacles in their life in a productive way. So in light of all that, I'm going to talk just briefly about what we're doing here to bring these things into life. So first year, I've only been here a minute, and as you know, I've been listening. So a lot of the time I've been listening, but I've not only been listening, because one of the other things that I heard loud and clear, particularly from the staff, is that it's time to stop listening and start doing. So there's a few things that we've done already. First off, we've hired a case manager to help us in our counseling center. We had a position that was allocated last year, and we were trying to think of the best way to to use it, and we decided to use it by hiring a case manager to help us with our students. Many of our students, again, those who come to us already needing treatment outside that are not necessarily being seen inside, we don't want them to feel like they're not connected to the institution. So a case manager will help to be a bridge between our counseling center and their outside treatment, helping them to get what they need and to stay connected with those students, as well as to support students who are here, who have a situation that they need to deal with psychologically and might have to take a leave, but to stay connected with them so that they can come back and be successful and graduate. We've also moved to online scheduling. We learned from a survey that we did in the spring that students felt that the wait was too long to get an appointment. And as we learned that they didn't even want to pick up the phone and make the call, that they really want to just be able to, when they're feeling like they need to see someone, to be able to go online and make the appointment right there. So we opened up online scheduling for urgent sessions. And it's a half an hour session. It's not like a therapy or treatment. It's a half an hour to sit with someone to talk about what's going on. And then we can schedule a more significant intake after that. And those sessions, we open them up so that you can make an appointment within 48 hours. So if you call on a Friday, you can get an appointment for Monday. And they just got snapped up so much that we had to open up more. So it's really being well utilized. We also contracted with something called WellTrack, which is an online psychoeducational program. So for those students who have anxiety but they're not quite sure how to understand it or what to make of it, they can go on and learn more about it. And then if it looks like they still need to see someone, then it refers them in and they can go in and see someone. And then finally, we improved the facility by creating a medical suite where the psychiatrists are in one section, and then we got a waiting room that's much more, you know, students were sort of sitting in the hallway when they needed appointments. So now there's a waiting room, and there's a big, like, massage chair in there, and we have some flowers, and, you know, there's sunlight, and it's just a much more pleasant space for students. Also, in terms of engagement, we hired a new leader in residence life. She starts in a couple of weeks. Her name's Helen Wang. She's coming from Carnegie Mellon, and she one of her accomplishments at Carnegie Mellon was to develop a residential curriculum. What are the things we want students to learn while they're living in the residence hall? Things like how to create a sense of belonging, things like confidence, and things like risk-taking, things like speaking up and self-efficacy. So she'll be coming soon. We're really looking forward to it. She's already been working with us, helping us to think about training for our new RAs and selecting our new RAs. We've also done an assessment of disability services to try to improve our policies and our practices around students who have specific disabilities. And then finally, in terms of empowerment, we had a leadership conference for first-year students in the fall. That was excellent, actually. We had about 30-something students who spent a day with a speaker and some colleagues training them in leadership development, and then we followed those students throughout the year to see how they're doing, to encourage them to be involved in different leadership opportunities. And then finally, something I'm really excited about, which is we're going to have a new Student Leadership Awards program coming in at the end of April, and it's going to be called the Camellia Student Leadership Awards. It's named after one of the longest-lasting gifts of Wellesley's founders. Henry and Pauline Durant gave the Camellia tree to the campus, and so it's an elegant example of a species of a flowering tree. The Durant Camellia is a symbol of strength, grace, and ongoing growth. And when we think about that, that's what we want to highlight for our students in terms of their leadership. And so there are different kinds of awards. There's a Resilience in Leadership Award, a Balanced Leadership Award, an Emerging Leadership Award, different awards that highlight those aspects that we think are important for student growth and development. So that will be coming up at the end of April, and we're really excited about that. So those are some of the things that are happening here on campus. And so I guess we can open it up for questions now.
Thank you, ma'am. At this time, we will conduct the question and answer session. As mentioned earlier, due to time constraints, we will be limiting questions to one per person. And we thank you in advance for your understanding. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone now. and you will be placed in the queue in the order received. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press star 2. We are now ready to begin. For our first question, we go to Betsy Harris, class of 19. I do apologize. First, we will go to Katie Wright, class of 2012.
Oh, great. Hi. I'm Katie Wright, class of 2012. And so I was a first-year mentor, and I definitely think that was a super important part of my Wellesley experience. So I was really glad to hear you highlight it. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on, more plans for what your office would like to change in the future with peer leadership and also just the benefits you see in peer leadership.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm excited to hear that peer leadership was one of the things that you took away as an important part of your Wellesley experience. As I said, I think the way in which our peer leaders influence students here is remarkable. So what I'm hoping for is more training for not only the first-year mentors but also the resident assistants and the other student leaders that we're involved in. At the moment, the way in which it works is the peer leaders work with the students during the first year. And what I'd like to see is more intentional, specific kinds of programs that they can do together. It's sort of open-ended at the moment. You know, after you get through orientation in the first few weeks of school, it's a little bit more flexible, and I'd like to see a little bit more structure. But I'd also like to see some more resources for the first-year mentors and others to be able to maybe take students, a group of students to go to a play or, some more structured opportunities to get students off campus together in groups and to highlight some of the things that are happening in the city so that students don't feel just restricted here to the campus.
And for our next question, we go to Betsy Harris, class of 1960.
Thank you. I'm delighted to hear what you have been telling us this morning, Dean Norton, and particularly am interested in diversity, and I have a question in regard to the effects of it on something maybe other than what you have been emphasizing so far this morning. And my question is the effect of diversity on the teaching practice, the classroom process at Wellesley, and also on the faculty-student relationship. Because when I was there, beginning in the fall of 1956, I had the impression that the faculty assumed that everybody had been to college before they ever came, that is, had been to great prep schools or had been to superb public school systems, and that the students were emotionally and psychologically mature, came from intact families. There were no African-Americans in my class or Hispanics from low-income urban or rural areas. Everyone was primarily from the Northeast and Caucasian and beautifully prepared. So I would have fallen in the world of the people who weren't there. But there I was, primarily because my mother had graduated from Wellesley in 1928, and that was my sole quality coming to Wellesley. Otherwise, I was totally inappropriate in retrospect, though I did graduate. So I am particularly interested in the effect of diversity on the teaching process and on the faculty-student relationship. Thank you.
That is an excellent question. And what I can say is that we are actually having conversations about that right now at the campus. We just about a week or so ago had a town hall meeting with students, diverse students, particularly first-generation college students, but it was open to all students, and many of our diverse students, students of color, as well as our first-gen students came to talk with specifically with the faculty about what their experiences were. And particularly, again, as you pointed out, those students who have different challenges that are not just of racial or even economic, but students who have different kinds of disabilities or anxieties, et cetera, were able to share with the faculty how the faculty's teaching impacts them personally. And the faculty, the first town meeting, the faculty had to just sit and listen, and we did not allow them to respond. They just listened because we wanted them to hear the students. And then we're coming back and having another town meeting actually in a week or so ago where the faculty and the students will engage in conversation about what is it that they can do differently to support students. This is all part of the inclusive excellence working group that the Academic Council has commissioned and consistent with Paula Johnson's vision of inclusive excellence. So it really is a work in progress right now, and it's actually very exciting to have the faculty listening and thinking about what is it that we can do differently. Our PLTC, which is the Teaching and Learning Center, the Four Horizons Teaching and Learning Center, they're also having workshops on how to, for faculty to improve their pedagogy, on how to strengthen group work and strengthen some of their teaching practices to ensure that they're inclusive for everyone. So that work is ongoing as well.
For our next question, we go to Robert Cheek.
Yeah, hi, Sheila. This is Bob Cheek, and first of all, I'd like to thank you for all of the hard work you've been doing. I know it's not an easy job having 1,000 bosses, but I had a quick question for you. Do you have a way of tracking kids? So if they're interested in leadership roles, that how do they obtain one? If they apply for several and don't get in, is there any way to track that or coaching that goes on?
Yes, that's a very good question, and it's one of the things that we're looking at right now. So I think I mentioned that we have a leadership working group. They're the ones that are putting together the leadership award ceremony. And the leadership working group, they put on that first-year conference, and they're following those first-year students. They're also involved with the colleagues who select the student leaders. So we have a student leader selection that includes all of our student leaders, so that would be the RAs, the HPs, et cetera. And when you apply for a leadership position, and then they select you into one of those positions. And we actually just started, as part of the leadership working group, thinking about, okay, what do we do for those people who aren't selected, to give them feedback about what it was about their candidacy that is the reason that they weren't, and to help them build the skills that they would need to be successful in the next opportunity. And then we're also trying to help students to understand that leadership is more than just a position, so that you don't have to have a position to be a leader. And so we're teaching them about ways in which they can be involved in different clubs, orgs, or other opportunities on campus, and yet utilize their leadership skills in those particular areas. Because, again, when they get ready to go into internships and jobs and things when they leave here, they want to take those leadership skills with them, and so we try to help them to think broadly about what leadership really means.
For our next question, we go to Judith Walker, class of 1973.
Hello. You're doing a wonderful job. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello? Oh, good. Great. Okay. I'm all for intersectionality and diversity. It sounds as if you're doing a wonderful job with respect to focusing on health and wellness and leadership. So I hate to throw a wrench into the works, but I'm interested in your perception on a particular aspect of student activism. Like many members of my class, I'm very concerned that Wellesley has gone to extremes to take a whole lot of money from a very, very right-wing group, the Koch Foundation, and while I understand that it's supposed to have an ecumenical bent, the Koch brothers are known for having an extreme view and for manipulating colleges in a way that shows that those colleges can lose their reputations by being bought. And because you're the dean of students, I wondered whether there is any activism on campus to uncoke the campus at this point.
I love that, uncoke the campus. I may leap that idea to the students. Well, I'll say there's not a movement to quote unquote uncoke the campus, but I will say that not long ago Paula Johnson put forth, right after that article that was in the Boston Globe, I'm not sure if you saw it, but Paula Johnson put out a note to the entire campus to make it very clear that while the Freedom Project specifically has received funds from a number of different places, including the Koch brothers, that Wellesley does not allow any outside group to direct the way in which we educate our students, and that includes having speakers on campus. So she made that statement very clear, and has recently sent out another note about the ways in which we want to, again, using the concept of inclusive excellence, the ways in which we want to ensure that freedom of speech happens on our campus, but that it also happens in a manner that allows for inclusive excellence. And so she is taking the lead on that. We are right there with her. The students, for the most part, are very supportive. And there's a real concern here, as there are in many other places, that we don't get to a point where speech gets shut down in some way, that different voices are not allowed. So we definitely want to make sure that different voices are allowed, but we also want to help people to think about the impact that you have on the campus. And so at this point, the focus is going to be on freedom of speech and in an inclusive community. So that's where we are with that.
And we go next to Nancy Kilburn, class of 1989.
Hi there. It is so wonderful to hear your message today. It's been a privilege to be on this call. And I am class of 89 and also have the privilege of being newly back on campus in the resources department, but really focusing on foundation and corporate relations. And as such, I have been able to work with Professor Oscar Nunez, who is going to be the new faculty director of the Learning and Teaching Center that you were mentioning.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask a question about, I believe he does a lot with experiential learning, and so I just sort of wanted to tee that up as to give you a chance to talk about experiential learning as a part of inclusive excellence or sort of anything in that realm, because that's been something that I have found very inspiring that seems different than when I was a student graduating in 89.
Sure. So I actually had a conversation with him just yesterday, day before yesterday, before the snowstorm. Our inclusive excellence model is really going to, is still, in development stages, but it's really going to create opportunities for faculty in all of the different disciplines to think about the ways in which the students are actually learning their material. So they're not just presenting the information how they've done it before, but they're really stopping for a minute and thinking about the people in front of them and the way in which those people in front of them are hearing and learning the information that they're teaching. And so part of the experiential learning, from what I understand, the ways in which Oscar's presenting it, he's done a lot of work with math, I understand, is to help think about creative ways to engage in real-life examples of the application of math. And so likewise with other professions, we're trying to engage the faculty to think about what are the real-life applications of the information that you're teaching students, because various populations will remember it better, they'll be able to use it better, and be more effective in their overall learning.
And for our next question, we go to Kathy Kaufman, class of 1967.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks so much for your insights and for all the ways you are already moving ahead. I just wanted to ask a little bit about the counseling center. I know that there are more and more students every year needing services, and I'm wondering how close you think we are to staffing up appropriately for the really enormous demands of our students.
Thank you for that question. I do think that we need additional staff in the counseling center. I don't think we have enough at the moment. And specifically, we need people. We need someone who specializes in different cultural counseling practices. So that is something that we're looking at this year and trying to think through what's the best way to resource that, because we're hearing from students that that it is indeed the cultural pieces that's the challenge for them, wanting someone who understands their cultural experience. We tried a new thing this year, actually started it last year and continued it this year. For Asian American students, we had a group, a specifically trained Asian American model for that population. We had a group for that population, and it turned out that we had like 40 students that took us up on the opportunity to be a part of that group, which is a remarkable number. And these are students that would not have come to the counseling center otherwise. And so we're beginning to learn that you need to use creative models, and you need to use culturally specific models that people can relate to. And so that's just an area that we really need to improve upon. And so it's something that we're looking very carefully at right now.
So I think we have time for one more question.
And that question will come from Gretchen Besser, class of 1949.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I came to campus in the fall of 1945 when we had just ended a major conflict. Four-year conflict, as you know, and it was a sea change for the world and for our country and for us. There was another Horton at our helm. Mildred McAfee had just married her husband, Mr. Horton. Mildred McAfee Horton was our president. And it was a time when women were first beginning to find our way in a man's world. We also had the feeling when we came to campus and were freshmen that it was indeed a work hard experience. That's nothing new. And it just seems so very, very long ago, and it was. There were no counseling facilities, nothing to help us along the way, and we learned and we managed and we got through it and hopefully helped the world in some way. But one of the biggest changes that we came up against was the development of women in our own right and finding a place for ourselves in the workforce and in the professions, hitting our heads constantly against glass ceilings. And I wonder now, with the new young people coming to campus, much of what we've seen is deja vu, but to what extent is this Me Too movement affecting the youngsters who are first beginning their journey to, I almost said adulthood, but to become wealthy alums? How do they feel about women's situation and the way in which women have been treated, so much of which is coming out now in the press?
That's quite a question. And God bless you. Class of 44, that's amazing. Okay, let me just say the Me Too movement here, we've not heard a lot about students concerned about it. But what we will say is that students here do feel very much empowered. The women here feel very much empowered in terms of speaking their mind and standing up for themselves in terms of sexual health rights and things like that. We have had different I'm thinking about, you know, the Women's March downtown, large numbers of students being involved in going to that. So students feeling really empowered in that way. And we have sexual health educators on campus, balanced health educators on campus. So students who are speaking with each other about keeping themselves safe and standing up, bystander education, you know, against other, you know, protecting each other when they're out in social situations. Part of their students' desire to have more social life on campus has to do with not wanting to, or at least some of what they've told me is not wanting to end up in a frat house, you know, at MIT somewhere, that they'd rather have social activities on campus and invite people here so that they can be in control of their environment. So I've been listening very carefully to the way in which students are thinking about some of these issues, and again, you know, as we proceed with the embrace, engage, and empower vision here, helping students to think about themselves in terms of the Me Too movement will certainly have to be a part of it.
Wonderful. Thank you again, Dean Horton, for sharing with us all that you've accomplished since you arrived just last summer. I look forward to seeing your vision of Wellesley continue to grow and support the academic and residential lives of our current students. To everyone joining us on the call, thank you again for listening in and for those amazing questions, and I hope to see you all at events either in Boston or New York City this May.
And if participants have any further questions, you may contact the Office for Resources at 1-800-358-3543. Again, that number is 800-358-3543. This will conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.